Menders, Episode 20, Integrating a Well-Being Curriculum into Medical Education with Dr. Liz Dykhouse.
You know, I'll say, these are the things we need to talk about in terms of promoting well-being. And they'll say, but like, I'm never going to be well if I have to see one patient every 15 minutes. And they're not wrong. And also, they have to like, we have to be able to sort of live within that system in order to promote change. Otherwise, we're not in the system.
You're listening to Menders with clinical psychologist and leadership consultant, Dr. Nicola DePaul. Each week, get a dose of real-world inspiration from free-thinking leaders, top clinicians, healthcare innovators, and myself. Looking for quick fixes or standard management tools? Try someplace else. Motivated to maximize the resilience and diversity of your team? Sustain your momentum as a leader and transform your healthcare system? Welcome to Menders. Welcome to Menders. Today we have Dr. Liz Dykhouse, and you're involved with family medicine residency education, and I'm going to have you share a little bit more about that. But I just wanted to provide a little bit of context first. So I invited you here to talk with me about residency training and creating nourishing environments for physician education. So I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. And also, full disclosure, you and I we were involved in the same doctoral program back in the day and focused on some international elements of psychology in our training. And so I'm also excited to touch on some of your current international work. So welcome.
Thank you so much. It's fun. It's fun to be here. Yes. And revisit those grad school connections.
Yes. So thank you so much for your generosity. So if you don't mind, would you just share a little bit about what your current roles are, what you're doing now, and how you got here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a clinical psychologist by training. The bulk of what I do now is in medical education. And specifically, I work with family medicine residency training. So family medicine as a specialty always has behavioral health, behavioral science curriculum, and it's often directed by a non-physician behavioral health provider like me, which I think is just a cool aspect of family medicine as it is. And so I do that for my residency, as I direct that curriculum. I've been doing that for a few years, and then recently have also stepped into the role of associate program director for the residency.
Wonderful. Thank you. So I'd love to hear more about, just what you find so meaningful about your work in medical residency education. Like, what draws you to that area?
Yeah, it's a good question. I backed my way into what I do very much so. I did a lot of my clinical training in graduate school and internship and postdoc in primary care settings that had integrated behavioral health, and our program even has some coursework in that model. And so that's the idea of bringing behavioral health practice into the primary care setting, which is where people go for their health care. So reducing stigma, increasing access, all those things. So did my training in that kind of model. And then as I graduated from fellowship and thinking about what I wanted to do next, I'd gotten some exposure to residency education when I was on internship and was really struck by this idea that if we want that kind of model to work really well, we need really well-trained behavioral health providers, but we also need really well-trained medical providers. And so started looking for things that had that kind of component to the job. And then, you know, once I got into it, just have done more of it. One of the things that we're trained as integrated behavioral health providers is, you know, that idea of assessing the needs of your clinic and your population and your providers and doing what you can to meet that need. And that's been a big piece of sort of how my career has gone, is sort of ending up somewhere and seeing that there's a need and doing what I can to fill it. And that's certainly been true over the last few years with the pandemic and the impact that's had on the world. But, you know, particularly on healthcare and healthcare workers and, residency's already a really difficult couple of years, and then to have that on top of it. And so kind of really, really sort of expanded my role in that area of being involved in resident wellness and well-being. And that's a long answer to your question about where do I find meaning in my work. But I think that's where I find meaning, is thinking about, you know, the health and the wellness of the world and what everything's going through, and how can I support the people that are supporting the people. A really powerful piece of what I get to do, that I feel really honored to get to do.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. And so when you and I have talked about your work before, you shared with me that you make a really clear distinction between wellness and well-being. So I wonder if we can just start there, because I think wellness is talked about a lot and is maybe the primary term that's used by organizations when they're talking about how to take care of their clinical employees. But you make a really important distinction. So I'd just love to start by exploring that and then kind of go from there.
For sure. Yeah. So, and I, you know, you can, this is, there's other people that will kind of talk in this vein too. With wellness, we really think that about that being sort of a state of health. And we'll talk about, you know, wellness as being making sure you're getting physical activity and drinking enough water and eating right and going to therapy and all of those kind of things. And that's really important. And I think well-being is a sort of broader, more complex, way of thinking about sustainability and about life that encompasses wellness, you know, that encompasses physical and mental wellness, but also encompasses social life and work sustainability and, you know, valued living, values directed living, and feeling empowered and systems change and all these different things that also go into having sort of a well life, a sustainable life.
Hey, if you're listening to this and you're not sure how to get started to address burnout and create a culture of well-being in your organization, and you're looking for a roadmap and someone to support your team through this process, listen up, because this is for you. Investing in your people is the smartest thing your healthcare system can do. Whether you have a tiny system or a large complex department, there are focused actions you can take to transform your organizational culture from burnout to well-being. I work with leadership teams to simplify and demystify this process so that you can feel really good about the efforts you're putting out in the world, and so confident that your investments in employee engagement and team well-being will pay dividends. Head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com and join me today.
That includes, again, that sort of wellness, that physical and mental wellness, but there's just so many more components to it, I think.
So just a richer and really complex approach to how we're caring for ourselves and each other or our whole system.
Yeah. And I think it's an important thing to acknowledge, because, you know, what I will hear, and I think lots of people hear when it comes to wellness related stuff, is, you know, I felt better today, but like that didn't solve the problems. And so when I think about training, you know, residents and thinking about their well-being and the skills that I want them to graduate with, you know, I want them to feel empowered to advocate for change and to, you know, address those kinds of things as well. I also want them to know how to take care of themselves individually, but there's all these different components to it. And I think if you have to sort of acknowledge that there are problems and challenges in order for that wellness piece to work. If you're just saying, you know, do these things and you'll be okay, that misses a really important and big piece of the picture.
And what is missing? What do you see as missing there?
Just that, yes, to focus on your wellness and your, you know, your individual health and is really important. And there are things in especially in healthcare, that are really challenging and really difficult that are still going to be there even when we are doing the best at sort of taking care of ourselves. And it's important to acknowledge that, because if we pretend that that's not there, that can feel really invalidating, for one. And it's worth talking about if there are things that should change in systems.
Yeah. I think something that I'm constantly working on, both for myself and then with people that I consult with, and then of course with the patients that I work with, is kind of finding a balance, you know, in that dialectic with like what's inherent within the system, what really can't be changed, and what could be changed, and how do we approach those two different things really at the same time and all of the time to create a system that's meaningful, that is less harmful, or that is more nourishing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about that balance, I think.
So how common do you think it is for residency training programs to address well-being from this bigger perspective?
You know, I think it's definitely something that lots and lots of programs are talking about. If you go to the national conferences, it's often, you know, many of the talks are on wellness curriculum and wellness programs and things like that. I think what I'm struck by when I go to those talks is it's a lot of that focus on like social activities together and sort of activities that feel good and are you know, enjoyable. And I think that's really, really important because we need those moments, just in life and particularly in residency, they need those moments. It's a really challenging few years. What I don't see as much in what I focus on with my curriculum is sort of those harder, bigger conversations and what do those skills look like? And I'll talk about with my residents with the curriculum that I have that, you know, I'm interested in their wellness now and during residency, but I'm also interested in helping them build the skills to have sustainable practice and sustainable life and to be well providers when they're done with residency. It's about now, but it's also about, you know, what skills I want them to graduate with.
Mm-hmm. So how do you approach that? Like, how do you create a structure that supports both of those things within a training program?
Yeah, so I'm really lucky to have inherited a structure from some psychologists that were in my role before me and were really incredible. And you know, I've worked to expand on it. So I think for one, like I get to work in an environment that already had a lot of respect for this kind of stuff. And then it has given me the space to build upon it. The way that I'll frame it, so that the didactic curriculum that I have with the residents, I get a 90-minute session with them once a month-ish. And I always do sort of an orientation to the curriculum at the beginning of the year, and I'll talk with them about, you know, that sometimes we're going to have sessions where we go get ice cream together and go for a walk and, you know, do those kinds of things and hang out in our social and talk about mindfulness. And then sometimes we're going to have sessions where we talk about really hard things and they're not always going to feel good, but it's important to have those conversations and sort of, you know, I'll sort of describe that there's like different levels of topics that I have. You know, and so, you know, some of the harder things are like, how do you deal with vicarious trauma and how do you, you know, cope with grief and patient, you know, losing patients? How do you cope with, you know, all those kinds of things, really dealing with really difficult patients? What does it look like to have boundaries? What does it look like to deal with power differentials? What does it look like to work on teams? All things that are not necessarily like fun to talk about, but are really important components of maintaining well-being.
Oh man, I love that. And I'm just laughing because those are the things that come up. I am still a primary care, integrated primary care psychologist. And those are the things that come up with my primary care colleagues, you know, on an almost daily basis as we're talking about those things. How do you set a boundary? How do you have a conversation with someone else on the team who just did something that you don't like or that doesn't feel good or that you know, there's some conflict within the team? Or what do you do when there's a new policy within the organization that you don't like or that you feel disrespected by? How do you engage that? So, you know, I guess for me, it feels like these are such fundamental skills that I wish everybody got while they were in their, you know, medical education training program, whatever discipline they're part of. But I don't necessarily see that most people have that training. And maybe that's, you know, just specific to what I'm noticing. But I think there's a lot of room for growth and, you know, continued development of comfort as we train clinicians of all disciplines in those kinds of skills.
And I think there are skills that can fit in different places. We can conceptualize them as fitting in different places. I conceptualize it as part of well-being because I think it is. I think it contributes to that ability to have a sustainable career. And kind of like I was saying before, I think the acknowledging that kind of stuff allows for the other pieces of it to get heard more. If we have these conversations about some of these harder things that, you know, they really need the skills to develop. When I have the sessions where like we're social and we go, you know, walk in the woods together, like my hope is that they actually get more out of those sessions then, because I'm not invalidating the fact that like there's the other stuff that's happening that needs to be talked about too.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine you're also creating just positive experiences or warmth and engagement with those people or the residents so that they can feel more connected with each other and with you, so that it's also easier to have the really tough conversations when that's needed as well.
Yes, definitely. Yep.
Yeah. So I guess this is a little off topic for residency training, but it's something I've been thinking about, and I think it's something you're speaking to. So for me, relationships and team building, especially within an integrated primary care environment, is like something that I just spend a lot of time thinking about. And I think something that I see occasionally happen are, communications, like top-down communications that maybe happen from leadership to the team that are just really clear, really direct, but not necessarily couched in like relationship. Or I'll see something along the lines of a lot of team building exercises and like, hey, rah, rah, let's all feel really good. But there's not the space for people to talk about what's really hard, what they're struggling with. And then, you know, I think the outcome that I observe is that there can be broken relationship or just missed communication, you know, when especially between leaders and frontline clinicians where there's just this bit of a disconnect. So I'm curious, are you able to address that or train your residents in how to bridge that gap, you know, trying to pursue both direct communication and relationship building and that team building element?
Hopefully. we certainly try to, I think, in our curriculum, and we're always, you know, innovating and trying to build new stuff. You know, one of the things that we'll talk about with our residents is that, you know, we have some different blocks in our schedule called Physician as Leader, and we'll talk about how a lot of times physicians do become leaders in different kinds of settings, and that's its own different set of skills that are really important to talk about. And, you know, we need to have good leaders that know how to do that kind of stuff because it's a trickle down. And so, you know, I think it's, if we don't have the hard conversations, it's easy to continue to not have the hard conversations. And then you never know how to have the hard conversations. It's exposure therapy a little bit, you know, of doing that. And it's one of the things I think about in kind of how and why I structure what I do. I don't want the first time that they have to have a really intense, hard conversation with somebody to be when they're like in charge of something. You know, I want them to be having these conversations now when I have the space to coach them and support them, and they're not totally in charge yet.
Yeah. that just sounds like a pretty remarkable holistic approach to physician training. So I'm just loving it. And I did want to also ask you, I know you also do physician training, I believe, with family medicine residents in Liberia. Is that correct? Can you share more about your work with those physicians? What does it look like when you apply these values-based principles within a different cultural context?
So my program has my department has an affiliated family medicine residency in Liberia that we've been working with for a couple years now. I got involved with them kind of around wellness related stuff with the pandemic. I'd been talking with the director of the global health training in my department before the pandemic started about getting involved, and actually had planned to travel and like May of 2020 to go there, which of course did not happen. So I had a little bit of a connection with them. And then when the pandemic started, they approached me just that their residents were really struggling with the idea of dealing with a pandemic after having just dealt with Ebola and still dealing with Ebola specifically. And, you know, trying to figure out how to support them. And so I did some group-based, some individual-based stuff with them over Zoom in the early months of the pandemic. And then they approached me and asked if I would be willing to kind of build more formal curriculum. And that curriculum actually has moved a little bit away from sort of like the wellness, well-being kind of focus and more into just behavioral health skills and, you know, basic counseling skills and dealing with chronic disease and behavior change and all those kinds of things that are also important components of the behavioral science, behavioral health curriculum. It's interesting because I have been, it's sort of a long answer to your question about like how do those values kind of get at play there, because I haven't sort of pushed some of that stuff because I think I recognize that values and culture may be at play. As I've built my relationships with them over the last couple of years, I've been bringing all of that up more and more, and they're really interested in it and they want to hear more. I think a really important piece of that work is a two-way conversation, is, you know, presenting to them, this is how I do things here and this is what I teach. And like, now you talk to me about how that fits into your community and with your population. Let's have a dialogue about it.
So what do you hear from them in terms of what is really important for them? I almost wonder if well-being is a more natural part of some other cultures, but maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I talk with them about, like, you know, things that are hard about medicine and about medical practice, they don't talk about dissimilar things than my residents here do. You know, long hours, lots of patients, sick patients, you know, that are, you have to deliver bad news to, you know, trying to get patients to buy into treatment plans and, you know, particular challenge in their communities is dealing with chronic disease and getting patients to come back for follow-up is always a conversation that comes up. But again, you know, that's universal in a lot of ways.
So just being human in all these different contexts. Yeah. So I'm curious if you see particular elements of maybe the Western medicine culture or Western medicine training culture that you try to be extra aware of as you're working with your own residents, just kind of recognizing, like, maybe these are some cultural values or standard operating procedures that might be more likely to contribute to burnout or, you know, difficulties down the road for physician trainees.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, and I think it's a medical culture thing of sort of the sort of go, go, go and give, you know, 120% of yourself all the time. And that's the hallmark of a good provider. And one of the things I'll talk about with my residents is, you know, in psychology training, we're sort of trained to think about where our limits are. I'm trained to think about when we are in a place that, like, we actually can no longer provide good care. And it's a conversation I like to have with my residents a lot, that, like, that's just true. There are, you know, we can push. And in the pandemic, there weren't a lot of people to kind of come in and help. There's a story amongst my residents of one resident who, you know, said at one point, like, there's no cavalry coming. We are the cavalry. And so, you know, this need to kind of continue to push through. And also there is a point where, like, you are no longer able to provide care and actually run the risk of starting to do harm. And so I think that's a component of sort of how medicine is the, like, go, 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 give it all. It's not sustainable.
So how do you help them to start to see that, or to, you know, to learn how to monitor themselves so that they can intervene or they can ask for help or say, like, hey, I'm at my limit. I'm not able to keep pushing forward. Like, what's the mechanism that you help them learn to do that process?
I think the hope is that we build an environment in which we're just talking about that enough that they know that they can. You know, I think it's a piece of why we want the well-being curriculum to be longitudinal and to be a regular part of the curriculum. We want them to know that these are conversations we need to be having all the time. And hopefully, you know, foster an environment where they feel safe coming to whoever. And we work really hard to try and have lots of different faculty who people can go to say, I'm struggling. And then we work to respond.
I guess I just acknowledge like that is actually really difficult and even difficult for, you know, a trained psychologist. Like I'm thinking of myself, you know, and I'm thinking of just with some of the recent really devastating global events that have occurred in the last couple of months. Like I know that I found myself struggling with a lot of distress, and then I would show up to my clinic and still be struggling with a lot of distress. And then I was seeing my patients. And, you know, there's at least one patient interaction that I can still think of that I'm remembering where I showed up and I was kind of like angry, jaded, frustrated, you know, not the like calming, competent, efficient, effective presence that I want and need to be. And so in the moment, I was recognizing that I was like, ooh, like this is a moment where I'm essentially showing up as like an impaired provider because my own emotional state is impacting how I'm interacting with my patients. And so I definitely did some work around that personally, both in the moment and later. But I was thinking to myself, like, what do I do in this moment? Because, you know, just my particular context does not actually encourage that kind of conversation or support seeking or limit setting, or like use of a mental health day or something like that. Though I am seeing more and more organizations that are doing that, moving that direction. And I think even parts of my organization are actually really good about promoting mental health days. So I guess I'm just recognizing like that is a really complicated thing. And so I can imagine for a trainee, it might be even harder because you have all that imposter syndrome or other pressure. So what are your thoughts about that? Do you have these kinds of conversations? Mm-hmm. What does it look like?
Yeah. Man, I have so many thoughts to all of that. I'm trying to organize them for you. So first of all, I think there's the question of like specifically how do we like promote learners to feel empowered to say they need help and that kind of thing, and I'll come back to that. But I think that that scenario you just described, I think there's different people in different schools of thought that would ask different questions in response to that, right? There are some people that would say, what are you doing to promote your wellness? And like, how did you sleep the night before? And like, what did you have for breakfast? And you had water recently. There are people who would sort of approach it that way. There's people who would approach it as, you know, like, what are the counseling skills that you need to say? What are the words that you say to a patient when you're feeling that way? How do you school your facial expressions? Sort of that kind of like, you know, micro scale in the moment kind of thing. I think then there's the people that would approach that and say, what sort of systems level things are at place here? Did you have too many patients scheduled that day? And like, how long did patients have to wait to get appointments? And, you know, the man on the system, I think, you know, so I think there's all these different levels in which we could assess what the problem is in that scenario. And I think they're probably all a little bit valid. And I think that's when So to go back to that complexity of the term well-being, I think all of those things go into that, and they're all things that we need to be talking about because it's not just one of those things. And if we say it's just one of those things, it diminishes the complexity of what's going on. And then, yeah, I mean, and then to go back to the how do you create an environment that allows learners to kind of know that? I think it's about culture and it's about you know, saying you're going to be there when they say that they need and then being there when they say that they need. The follow through is really important.
Yeah. Being present and just showing up and following through. Yeah. I know this is out of your area, but do you have thoughts about how we could create that for staff? You know, a similar system that provides that level of support?
Oh man, I don't, yeah, I think there are, there are so many things that need to be kind of changed in systems. You know, there are ways in which people kind of, I think, unintentionally get punished for when they say, you know, I need help, or I need to back off, or I need to do this thing. And people get rewarded for doing the 120% and working themselves to the bone kind of thing. And so I think that's, you know, an important thing to acknowledge and to think about how we're doing that. You know, with our residents, if they come to us and they say they're really struggling and it's not working, we take a look at their schedules and we see, you know, if we can adjust things, or, you know, we've got a couple different, you know, people. We've had residents go on leaves. We've had residents go on partial leaves. We've had residents do like wellness electives where they, you know, had a little bit of a reduced schedule and had some time built in for going to the doctor and to their appointments and spending time with family and going to the gym or whatever it is that they feel like they need to do. You know, there are, we try, and when they come to us, kind of help them assess like what are the things that are getting in the way that they do have some control over? And how do we help them kind of focus on those things while also acknowledging that systems level of challenges.
I guess what you're speaking to in terms of like lightening the load or trying to look at, you know, what can be done or adjusted or shifted. I am hearing more about organizations trying to take that into consideration when they're trying to care for their employees and care for patients. I know it's such a tricky balance though, especially with the increasing demand. And just really high levels of need within the community. So I'm just curious, though, there's such a demand for patient care, and there's such a need for clinicians to have reduced, like more human schedules or more humane schedules. And, you know, I think there's really understandable arguments for why schedules are built the way they are. I don't necessarily think that they, you know, that it is healthy for physicians to see a new patient every 15 minutes. But I appreciate the rationale, you know, the patient flow rationale or the access rationale. I can appreciate the logic of the argument, even though I don't think it's very humane. So I guess I am just wondering, how does your program try to find a balance there between like what is humane and reasonable or realistic for the resident, and, you know, what is also continuing to help your organization meet the patient demand for access to clinical care?
Yeah, that's an absolute challenge. And there are, you know, medical directors and you know, people at that level that have to answer those questions. And unfortunately, I don't. You know, I get to focus on the residents and helping them with that. But it is a conversation that we have. I think that goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier about, you know, I'll say, these are the things we need to talk about in terms of promoting well-being. And they'll say, but like, I'm never going to be well if I have to see one patient every 15 minutes. And they're not wrong. And also, they have to like, we have to be able to sort of live within that system in order to promote change. Otherwise, we're not in the system. So I think being really honest about that dynamic is important. And sort of acknowledging both and promoting both sort of those individual wellness skills, and also promoting skills for, you know, advocating for change. So all that to be said, your question about like the patient demand piece is, I don't have the answer there. I just know that if we all burn out, there's nobody to see anybody. I don't know how we meet the demand. It is very, very overwhelming.
Yeah, I guess I appreciate that acknowledgement. I haven't run into anyone else with the answer to that either.
When you find them, let me know, hey?
I will. I definitely will. I have talked to a few people recently who are working outside of the traditional healthcare system, and so are in systems that have, you know, like a different reimbursement strategy or just a different structure that allows for some differences. But I guess the thing that I have found most helpful working within the system myself and working collaboratively with healthcare leaders in a variety of different settings, you know, within the traditional setting or system, is just the willingness of leaders to actually have the conversation. I think like you're modeling, being willing to talk about it, to even acknowledge like, hey, this is hard. I'm asking you to do something that is really challenging. I don't have a better answer. Can we be creative? How can I support you in, you know, caring for yourself while you're here? And that's not a perfect solution, but those seem to be the leaders who I have observed with the best relationships with their staff and with the happiest staff. And also there's some research that came out during, I think in 2021, so the earlier stages of COVID pandemic, that was looking at impacts of things like leadership support and showing how powerful that was on employee well-being and satisfaction within the organization. So they actually were not looking at, you know, patient load. That was kind of left out entirely. It was just, how supported do you feel by your leadership? And then, yes, if you feel supported, that was really making a difference. And more people were staying in the organization, even though, you know, things might be going totally nuts at the time.
And I think feeling supported is both like, you know, helping to make changes and that kind of thing. And it's also just acknowledging that struggle and that suffering. And when I think about physicians, you know, and if at any point any of my residents listen to this, they're going to laugh about what I'm going to say next, because they've all heard me say this so many times, is that, you know, in medical education, they're being trained to be problem solvers. And so much of what we're dealing with right now, there's not solutions to. And so that there's so much distress that comes with being presented with a problem that they can't solve, because that's the way that they're trained to think. And I'll talk about how, you know, as psychologists, we're trained to think a little bit differently. We're trained to problem solve, sure, sometimes, but we're trained to like problem absorb a little bit, maybe. I don't know what the right term is there necessarily. And that like sometimes what people need to feel supported and heard is not actually problem solving, but it's that sort of listening and that problem sort of hearing thing, in that, you know, if you want to be a good leader and provide good behavioral health care and all these different things, like you need to have problem solving skills, but you also need to be able to sit with problems that you can't solve.
Yeah. Wow. Is that ever true? Yeah. I'm thinking of a colleague, a former colleague, who told me point blank, it's not the problems that are the problem for me. It's when I can't fix the problem and I feel really stuck and helpless. That's when I start feeling like I'm at risk of burnout. And yeah, and I totally get that. And I love how you're bringing in like, well, maybe sitting with distress is actually enough. Maybe it's not going to fix the problem in a traditional sense, but maybe it would be a really powerful intervention in this moment and even in this system.
Yeah. And if we know that change takes time, I mean, you know, we also have an advocacy curriculum that we're newly developing that I think has some serious overlap with the well-being curriculum. And if we're thinking about that, if we're thinking about that, we want to promote change. System change takes a really long time. And if we're not still here, we're not going to get it there. So we also have to stay in it somehow. And some people don't. And that's also okay. And that's another thing, you know, I'll talk about with the residents is if they come to me and they're like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. I think there's a lot of people who would respond and say, no, medicine's important and you can get through and all of this. And my response is always, okay. Like, if that's what you're telling me, that this is not for you and you can't do this, I will help you figure out how to get out of it. Because that's important to acknowledge too. There are lots of amazing, excellent, wonderful, sustainable, valuable careers out there, that people can do. This is a hard one.
Wow. So you're really creating space for some pretty powerful and really tough conversations as people explore what makes sense for them.
Yeah, the problem with not creating space for that is that it doesn't make it not exist.
Right. So how do you approach training physicians in advocacy, like systemic advocacy? What kind of principles are you trying to help them learn?
That's a standby question. I don't have the answer yet. I actually literally just met with our new director of advocacy curriculum yesterday. So we're in the process of formalizing and building some more curriculum. There has been some, of course, in the curriculum, but we're really interested in making it more formal. So So I don't know. I just think it's an important piece that we need to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really hearing that that's such a natural outgrowth of the well-being piece. Like, do what you can to take care of the organization and the individuals within it, and then start to think about how can we sustain people for the long haul by engaging the system and creating transformation, whatever that looks like. So for you, I mean, what keeps you motivated to stay in this work and to be, you know, giving of yourself and, you know, just exploring new things and learning new things and modeling this kind of well-being and advocacy and systemic engagement for your residents?
That's a good question. I think, you know, I think the short answer is that I really like what I do. And I find a lot of meaning and a lot of value in what I do. And so I think that's a big piece of it. You know, I there are different things I do to kind of have balance and structure and boundaries. For example, I don't do patient care stuff at home. I do about 40% patient care still at this point, but I do notes at work. I do telehealth at work. I don't do that from home. That's a really firm boundary I actually started setting for myself in graduate school. That doesn't help me if that sort of bleeds over into my home life. That being said, there's a lot of work that does bleed over the 40 hours, you know, to do kind of the work that I do. It's a lot of after hours and weekends conversations and different work. And I try really hard to think about what are the pieces of my job that I really enjoy and are really powerful and sustaining. And those are the things that I let bleed over into nights and weekends. I try to keep the stuff that I don't like as much, to sort of the work hours, and then I try not to let that stuff bleed over into the rest of my life. You know, I really like building didactic presentations and lectures and things like that. And so I don't mind doing that on a Saturday morning with a cup of coffee. I like it. I'm not going to write notes on a Saturday morning because I don't like that.
Oh, yeah, that's great. I love that. I can't remember the last time I wrote a note on a weekend. It's been a long time. At some point, I embraced, like, you know, any note can wait the weekend if it really has to. It's just fine. It's okay. I mean, a couple very rare exceptions for that, but really, it does not need my attention. And the things that I'm doing at home on my nights and weekends are also like, what is intellectually grabbing my attention? What's enlivening for me? What gives me so much energy? And it can sometimes be a problem because then I can't sleep because I'm just feeling wired because I had fun. But I love how you're making that decision and thinking about what's worth my time in my off hours and what is not. So it's great modeling too. Well, is there anything else that you would love for people involved with residency education or, you know, just helping to train the next generation of clinicians to know or to think about as they care for and train, you know, that population of clinicians?
I think what I would say is it's hard work and we're all just trying to figure it out. I think, you know, the thing that for me that's been really helpful in terms of the sustainability of it is, you know, through different organizations and different connections, really building the group of people that do what I do in different, you know, in different residencies around the country. And so I've got a couple of different groups of people that I can shoot text messages to and say, what are you guys doing around this? And I think that, having a community of people that kind of get what you do and you can bounce ideas off of is really important because it's helpful to have that. But it's also really normalizing. You know, that was definitely a thing, particularly, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic when everything was just so uncertain. There were so many messages that went back and forth of like, everybody around you is melting down too, right? Okay. It's not just us. Okay, great. At least we're not alone. And how hard this all is. And I think that social connection piece is really important, at least for me.
Oh, yeah. No, I hear you there. I remember seeing one presentation early on. It was something about like, this is a normal response to stress. And, you know, and I think the audience was psychologists. It was all primary care folks, so psychologists, physicians, and nurses. And so basic information that we all needed to know or all knew, but all really appreciated seeing together and being like, oh, yeah. You know, we're humans and this is really hard. And we're having these reactions to this unexpected external situation that are kind of out of our control in some way. It's just how being a human, you respond to something going on. And that was, I just remember this moment as being so powerful because it helped me to feel so much more connected to all of the people who were, I think, similarly struggling in those early days in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Another thing my residents will hear me say a lot is that, you know, any medical interaction, when you boil it down, is ultimately an interaction between two humans, two or more humans. And you can't remove that piece of it.
Yeah. And that's really where the healing happens anyways, in that relationship, at least from my perspective. Oh, wow. Well, Liz Dykhouse, thank you so much for joining me today on Menders. It was such a pleasure.
So fun to talk with you, Nicola.
Same. All right. Well, take care.
Thank you for listening to Menders. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend. And don't forget to head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com to get started creating cultural transformation for your healthcare team today. Let's create transformation magic.